I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The story of Savelle Edmonds raises tough questions about the way the government manages its secrets. Savelle is the woman who was hired to work as a translator at the FBI just days after 9/11. She speaks Turkish and Farsi and Azerbaijani and English. Well, within short order, she says she realized that there were some serious problems at the FBI's Office of Translation. Problems that could compromise the essential information the FBI was gathering from before and after the attacks. However, Savelle Edmonds' warnings to her superiors were dismissed, and ultimately she was fired. When she tried to pursue the case, Attorney General John Ashcroft moved to silence her by invoking the rarely used state secrets privilege. Now, even the case that Savelle Edmonds was pursuing for wrongful dismissal has been thrown out of court. The judge said it would have been illegal to examine that evidence in court. This hour, we'll talk with Savelle Edmonds and others in Washington about the use of secrecy. We'd like to hear from you as well. Do you think that too much information is being kept from the public? Or do you trust the government to decide what's safe to disseminate and what's better kept under wraps? Now, as your own sense of America's promise of free speech, checks and balances, and open government changed in the past 3 years? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Savelle Edmonds, the former FBI translator, is joining us from our Washington NPR studios. Welcome to The Connection.
Good morning, and thank you for having me on your show.
You got this invitation from the FBI to come to work just days after 9/11, but I understand that you'd applied for work with the FBI some years earlier. What was going on there?
Correct. I applied for a position with the Bureau in 1997, and at that point they were interested in my language abilities, so they asked me to take proficiency exams in certain languages and other application procedures. And then they told me that they would have to conduct background investigations for granting top security clearance, and that the process would take anywhere between 9 months to 15 months, and that I would hear back from them. And I didn't. And at the end of 2000, when I called the Bureau to just find out the status, they told me that they had lost my application and all my test results, along with 150 other translators. And they were apologetic, and they said they would expedite this background investigation process. And I got a call from them 3 days after 9/11 on September 14, 2001.
When you got that call, did you hesitate before going into work at that time?
Well, actually, at that time, I was taking 18 credits at the university, getting ready for my master's degree. And a lot of things was going on in my life. However, considering the situation we were at that time, and the callings from the Bureau and TV basically begging for people with language skills, especially for Middle Eastern language skills, to just come and join the Bureau, it was just a sense of duty, and it was something that I considered my duty to do, so I started working for them right away.
And what was it that you were doing there, Savelle?
Well, I was a contract linguist, and I was translating for three languages, for Turkish, Farsi, and Azerbaijani. And my tasks included all sorts of translations, documents, audio, live interviews with certain detainees. It was just all over the range of various duties that you perform as a linguist for the Bureau.
You were, I understand, looking at some material that had been gathered prior to 9/11 and some of the material that was coming in on a daily basis. Is that right?
Correct. In fact, most of my assignments, my tasks, had to do with, again, documents, audio that were collected, and some of them were translated, actually, previously, and some of them were among those backlogs. And most of them were from some of them dating almost a year before 9/11.
And you were seeing some irregularities in the translation work that had been done before 9/11, am I right?
Correct. And I reported these issues and these incidents in writing to my superiors.
What sort of thing were you looking at, Savelle? Were there details that had been missed, or were people getting their facts wrong? What did you see?
There were several issues. In certain cases, I would receive documents from other field offices asking for certain documents to be retranslated, considering what occurred in 9/11 and in light of 9/11. And going through those previously translated documents, we came across many documents. And again, these can be audio, it can be written documents that were not translated accurately. And in certain instances, maybe they were due to just incompetence. But in certain instances, it was obvious that the mistranslations were intentional. As in some cases, documents were just stamped as not pertinent to be translated.
How specific can you be with us on this, Sibel? I mean, were you looking at references to the places that were targets at 9/11? Were there names of the hijackers there?
Well, actually, it goes beyond that because I can give you one example without getting really specific. Certain field agents send, and this was criminal investigation, not counterterrorism, and this was the case with most of those investigations that we ended up getting a lot of information after 9/11, and those cases were under either counterintelligence or criminal investigations. So this particular agent resent certain documents that were previously translated to our office from his field office, and and ask for this translation to be checked because, considering what occurred in 9/11, he believed, and it was rightfully so, that certain significant information was missed and was not mentioned in the original translation. So after going through this document and translating it verbatim, and after seeing what this document contained, we just went to file and send this retranslated document to the agent. However, we were prevented from doing so because doing so would have gotten the original translator in trouble. Therefore, this agent, who had significant information and he had a hunch about that, never received the factual, accurate translation. In fact, they sent him a brief note saying that the translation in question was checked and that everything was fine and the original translation was verified. It's just one small example.
But that was a lie.
Well, yes. And when I brought this issue up with my supervisor, with my direct supervisor at that time, what he told me was this. He said, "How would you like it if another translator were to do the same thing to you and you get into trouble for what you have done? And we don't do things like that here within the Bureau. We are family and we are protecting each other, so you don't do things like that here."
I want to be really clear about this, because if I understand what you're saying correctly, we're talking about material that might have changed what the agency knew or might have changed how the agency reacted to warnings about 9/11. And you've got a supervisor in those weeks after 9/11 saying, "We don't want to look back and correct anything else because someone here's feelings might get hurt."
Correct. Absolutely. And not only that, I don't know whether that investigation on that particular target was ceased to continue because the agent did not receive this information even after 9/11. Did we let that person or the target just leave the country? I don't know. And that is even more important that in light of what happened here, 9/11, we could do things like that. You know, the Bureau could do things like that and not only jeopardize previous investigations, but also jeopardize our security for any possible threat that we may be facing, you know, at that time or in the future.
Now, I know that there were a number of other irregularities that you noticed at the time, and I want to just sort of set those aside and move ahead if we can, because this issue of what you did with the information that you knew is where I want to go next. You took it to your immediate supervisor. You got the answer that you told us about. Did you go further on up the food chain?
Oh, absolutely. I started reporting this to my immediate supervisor, and with certain significant cases and issues, he told me that he took the case and reported it to his superiors and to the security department. However, a month later, when I took the case higher up, we realized, this is the special agent and I who were working on certain cases, that in fact this was not reported to higher ups. So I continued reporting these issues all the way up to the director level, to Director Mueller and his assistant Dale Watson. And basically along this around this time, they kept coming and telling me that this would end up being can of worms, and these issues were better left alone, and that if I were to continue reporting these, I would be investigated and they would fire me. And at that point, I realized that these issues had to be reported somewhere outside the agency. And the only places I could go were the Senate Judiciary Committee, because they do have the oversight, and also the Inspector General's Office for the Department of Justice. And I filed these issues with them on March 7, 2002.
It was also in March of 2002 when you were fired by the FBI, right?
Correct. First, before they fired me, they accused me of communicating this information with the Senate. And this was before I went to the Senate. So they came to my house and they confiscated my home computer and basically accusing me of communicating this information via email with the Senate. And that was not the case. And they did not find anything in my computer because I had not. And then they asked me to take a polygraph exam regarding these issues and whom I have reported to. And I took the polygraph exam and I passed the polygraph exam. And 2 weeks later, and this is 3 weeks after I reported these issues to the Senate and to the Department of Justice's Inspector General's office, they fired me. And the only reason they cited was purely for the convenience of the government.
They have since said in some media reports that I've read that they didn't like your performance. Did they say anything about that?
Absolutely not. And I have their reasonings all in writing, because that's how I was notified about being fired. And in fact, they were saying that I was not fired, I was terminated, and that there was a difference between getting fired and being terminated. And that was the only reason they cited. In fact, I had commendation letters from almost all agents, field agents that I worked with. I passed the polygraph, and in terms of my home computer, they did not find anything because there was not anything there. And the last thing that they could resort to was citing this vague statement purely for the convenience of the government.
And you did have a chance to make your case to the Senate Judicial Committee in the summer of 2002, right?
Yes, I had several meetings with the Senate members, with Senator Grassley and Senator Leahy. And most of these meetings took place inside a SCIF. SCIF is a secured compartmentalized intelligence facility. That's the place you can basically specifically talk about issues and bring in documents, etc. And in June and July 2002, the Senate Judiciary Committee members had meetings with the Bureau, and during these unclassified meetings with the FBI authorities confirmed all my allegations and they denied none.
Now that's a key point, and I want to bring that up when we come back after the break. Just a note for our listeners, we contacted both the Department of Justice and the FBI, and they declined our request to even discuss the case of Sybel Edmonds. A spokesperson for the FBI said, quote, "Since it involves both classified issues and pending litigation, there is really nothing we can say." We're going to talk about the classification of information, because that's key in this case, when we come back. Our telephone number for you to join us is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My guest this hour is Sybel Edmonds. She's a former FBI language specialist who worked there from just after the 9/11 attack, September 2001, until March 2002, at which point she was fired by the FBI. And Sybel, when we left this story, you were telling us that the FBI people who appeared before the Senate Judicial Committee, in effect, confirmed everything that you had said was going wrong at the department. Did I get that right?
Correctly, correct. They had two meetings, one in June and one in July 2002. And for these meetings, the Bureau did not ask for the discussions to be classified. So the meetings were unclassified, and most people present did not have top security clearances. And they openly discussed the case for hours. And during these meetings, they confirmed that, in fact, they had failed in realizing that one translator that they had hired had past and ongoing relations with the top targets of FBI investigations, this top target organization, and people within that organization. And they also confirmed that certain translations were intentionally blocked and that certain translations were intentionally mistranslated. And so they confirmed all these issues, and that was when the Senator Grassley and Senator Leahy, they wrote public letters to Attorney General Ashcroft, to Director Mueller, to Inspector General Glenn Fine, and they made statements to the press saying that FBI, in fact, had confirmed all my allegations and they had denied none.
So that should have been the end of the story, but for getting further into the investigation. But the Attorney General John Ashcroft and FBI Director Robert Mueller invoked something called the state secrets privilege a few months later. What does that mean?
State secret privilege, I guess I'm going to let Mike actually explain that further, because the state secret privilege is, as far as I understand, is rarely invoked.
Right.
And it's an absolute privilege. And in fact, I don't know of any case where administrative personnel within the Bureau have had anything like that cited on their case. And it's a very extreme privilege to assert. And in asserting this state secret privilege, Attorney General Ashcroft keeps citing the information being necessary to protect certain diplomatic and foreign relations. So this was asserted on October 18, 2002. And as you just mentioned, after taking this case to the Senate and taking it to Inspector General's office for Department of Justice, I believed I had done all I could do, that all it was my duty. I had reported it to the Senate, our legislative branch. I have reported it to the executive branch's supposedly independent investigator. And also I filed this motion in courts, which is our judicial branch, and that I just had to just sit and see actions being taken. However, for past 2 years, this administration, Attorney General Ashcroft, has relentlessly been fighting this case on every ground. He has been blocking the report from being issued, and this is a report by the Inspector General's Office for the Department of Justice. And as you just mentioned, the information that they disseminated during unclassified meetings with the Senate now is considered reclassified, and they are gagging the Congress on any issues that relates to my case. And recently, they stopped the court procedures and the court proceedings in my case. So it has been this 2 years relentless efforts of trying to quashing this case.
Now, you mentioned Mike. That's Michael Kirkpatrick. He's going to be joining us in just a couple of minutes. He's standing by also in our NPR Washington studios. He's an attorney at the Public Citizen Litigation Group with a similar case. Just, Sibel, before I move, though, to Mike's perspective here, does this all mean that you really shouldn't be talking about this when the state secrets privilege is put over the information that you were giving to the Senate and that you were talking about and that was being published in letters? When that's put back in, does that mean you're not really supposed to be talking about this?
Well, this is what they are claiming, and they are claiming, they being the government attorneys, they're claiming this in order to cover up these issues that they have already confirmed. They have already confirmed that my allegations are valid and that they have confirmed that these issues have been accurately reported by me. However, they have not taken any steps, any corrective measures to address these issues, and they have kept citing this diplomatic and certain diplomatic and foreign relations. Look, on September 11, 3,000 lives were lost, okay? And yet this administration has hindered all past and ongoing investigations into the causes of that horrific day for the sake of this vague notion of protecting certain diplomatic and foreign relations. And today we are still under this terror. terrorist threat, and they are not taking these necessary measures to address these issues and actually fix these problems. And they are citing what? They are citing to protect certain diplomatic and foreign relations. Well, isn't it time to ask what diplomatic or foreign relations they keep referring to? Or isn't it fair to demand that they should let the people know what kind of foreign relations is worth 3,000 lives?
Sibel, just hang on for half a second. I want to come back to you, but I'd like to bring Mike Kirkpatrick in at this point. As I mentioned, Mike is with an attorney at the Public Citizen Litigation Group representing the Project on Government Oversight. That goes by the acronym POGO. And that's a suit as well against Attorney General John Ashcroft. Mike, is that right?
Yes, it is, Dick. Our lawsuit was filed just 2 weeks ago, and our concern is a little bit broader than Ms. Edmonds' case. Our lawsuit challenges the reclassification of the information that she mentioned that was given by the FBI to the Senate Judiciary Committee during those two briefings in the summer of 2002. That information was then summarized in letters from Senators Leahy and Grassley back to officials at DOJ, in which they did indicate that the FBI had verified Ms. Edmonds' allegations, and those letters asked for further inquiry, further investigation, and questioned the adequacy of the FBI's translation capabilities.
Michael, can the government legally do this, allow information to be put out there, and then to decide at some point after the fact that, no, it should be classified and therefore never spoken about again, removed from websites, et cetera, et cetera?
We think not, and that is what our lawsuit is all about. This information was out in the public record. It was up on the senators' websites. It was picked up by websites all over the internet. And 2 years later, on May 13, 2004, the FBI comes back to the Senate Judiciary Committee and says the information we discussed with you in an unclassified briefing 2 years ago is now classified, so you should avoid any further dissemination. The problem there is classification is only appropriate where the information is either still within the exclusive control of the government in terms of an initial classification, or if it's a reclassification, the information has to be reasonably recoverable. This information is not reasonably recoverable because for 2 years it's been out on the internet. There's no way to get that information back. Therefore, it is our position that it cannot properly be reclassified. And that's why we've sued John Ashcroft, who has taken personal responsibility for that decision, to say he did not follow the classification rules because this is public information, not sensitive national security information that's exclusively in the control of the government.
When you talk about controlling the information or recovering the information or containing the information, John Ashcroft was quoted some time back as talking about it as spilled milk and whether or not the spilled milk can be properly put back in the jar or not.
That's right. That was in response to a question by Senator Grassley just a month ago at a Senate Judiciary Committee oversight hearing. And the Attorney General did make those comments. And it's really sort of mind-boggling because this is an example of the milk can never be put back in the bottle. In this case, the information is out there. In fact, it's even available in some of the pleadings that were filed in Ms. Edmonds' lawsuit, which has now been dismissed. But some of these letters and this same information was attached as exhibits in some of the pleadings. That's available from the federal court's electronic case filing system, which anybody who subscribes to that for 7 cents a page can go and pull these documents down. And they're really out there all over the place. Now, our client, the Project on Government Oversight, it wants to engage in public debate about the adequacy of the FBI's translation capabilities. But now that it knows that this information is classified, it's reluctant to further disseminate it. So we've gone to the court to say, first of all, this information is not properly classified,
right,
because you can't reclassify it if it's not reasonably recoverable. But second, by doing this, this is an improper prior restraint on our client's First Amendment right. This is having a chilling effect. It's stifling public debate. And that's not the purpose of the classification system.
All right. Let's see if we can bring some of our listeners into this conversation. It sparked quite a bit of interest. We're going to start in Newport, Rhode Island, and Kaysen's on the line. Hi, Kaysen.
Good morning. First, let me thank your guests for what I consider to be legitimate patriotism. And I have a question for Ms. Edmonds. Specifically, are you suggesting that the translations, in fact, or allegedly, could have altered or prevented 9/11?
That's a good question. To answer that with 100% certainty would be impossible. However, all that information that was prevented from getting to the agents, and in certain cases, intentionally, put together with all the other specific information that we had, could have played a major role in most likely preventing it. At least we would have been under this color-coded alert system back in June, July 2001, because we had that much information. And in certain cases, as I have said, this information came through counterintelligence and criminal investigations. And in certain instances, the investigations were not intentionally transferred to counterterrorism due to certain diplomatic relations. So they would let certain people get away with certain acts against this country just for the reason that they're citing certain foreign relations.
All right. 1-800-423-8255 is the number to join our conversation this hour. What do you think? Do you think too much information is being kept from the public, or do you trust the government to decide what is safe to disseminate and what's better kept under wraps? To Boston next, and Frank's joining us. Hi, Frank.
How you doing, Dick?
I'm fine. What do you think?
I'm jealous. First of all, I'm jealous of your guest. I wish I could speak four languages. Except I wish she would learn how to speak one correctly. English.
What are you missing, Frank?
Well, Hold on. Here's my point. My security is under protection by my president, who was duly elected. Now, I was scribbling down a couple of notes here while I'm listening, and I misspelled dually, and it came out dully, if you get it. So my point is, we are under attack. Hello?
I'm with you. Go ahead.
Okay. We are under attack by a bunch of religious fanatics, and John Ashcroft is absolutely right to use state security privilege. It may be a relatively unused act, but it still is one of President Bush's tools to use.
And, Frank, if it were to come to light that the FBI or the CIA, we're going to hear about that tomorrow when the Senate Intelligence Committee delivers its report, if it were to come to light that the agencies or this government messed up the handling of information, do you want to know that or do you not want to know that?
Let me put it this way, and pardon my French, but people screw up. Of course I want to know it. I truly do want to know it. But again, we are under attack. And the president, who was duly elected, is doing a great job. And we need to have him use every tool that he has available to him.
I wonder if I can turn to Michael Kirkpatrick on this, because understanding the use of the state secrets privilege, which was brought in here. Michael, can you tell us whether or not this is something that is in fact used very rarely or has been used a lot by this administration, just to sort of help Frank and myself and others understand how the information is being controlled here?
Yes, there's really two issues here, and they're separate but related. One is the state secrets privilege, which has been used to deny Ms. Edmonds her day in court. That is very rarely used. The other issue, though, is the reclassification of information that is already out there in the public domain and cannot properly be classified. That, unfortunately, is not something rare in this administration. George W. Bush is the secrecy president. Overall, classification activity is way up. This administration, like your caller, Frank, seems to think that secrecy guarantees safety. We don't think that's true. And in fact, the abuse of the classification system can undermine national security by increasing the likelihood of leaks. We've seen a lot of leaks in this administration, and I think leaks happen when people lose confidence in the classification system because they see information being overclassified or used for improper purposes. The purpose of the classification system is to keep sensitive national security information secret. It's not to make public information secret in an attempt to stifle discussion or undermine congressional oversight or put some of this information out of the reach of litigants.
Sibel Edmonds, what do you say to people like Frank who say, you know what, we have to trust the leaders even if there are whistleblowers and people like you say things aren't working. Ultimately, we have to go with the people who are elected.
Well, I understand there are many out there who believe that because of what they are being told and because of what they read. However, what they don't know, because this administration has not made that information public, and that is not due to national security, is that during some of these investigations that I translated for, you had several points where you had your counterintelligence, then your drug-related and your money laundering activities-related investigations overlapped with counterterrorism, okay? And we're not looking at only one country. We're not only looking at certain fanatic religious organizations. The scope is much wider than that, and the people, they don't know this because this information is being prevented from getting out. So they are under this assumption, and they are being given this fear and this paranoia of absolute secrecy being necessary to override our rights, our constitutional rights, and our rights to know. And that is very dangerous because it's apparent that this administration confidently expects us to people to sign blank checks unquestioningly. And they want us to commit to their contracts without being entitled to even see or read these contracts because they are saying they know the best. It's obvious that they believe they're entitled to this unchecked power, unlimited authority, and unquestioning citizen support like Frank's. And to them, our Bill of Rights is nothing more than an inconvenient roadblock to overcome.
I should remind our listeners, we made a number of attempts to contact the Department of Justice and the FBI to join us on this program. They both declined. However, we'd like to hear from you, our listeners. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. This hour, we're talking about the story of Sibel Edmonds, who was fired from her job as a translator with the FBI. Now, that happened March 2002, and since that time, she has been pursuing it through the congressional routes and also through the courts. Just yesterday, a federal judge threw out two cases, one on wrongful dismissal and one for a recovery of some of the letters that were taken from Sibel Edmonds in gathering the case. And Sibel Edmonds, I understand that this judge, in his short ruling, admitted to having some considerable consternation about throwing it out, but said that the government has properly invoked the state secrets privilege, and so he couldn't even hear the evidence. Is that right?
Well, as far as we know, the government attorneys had at least two in-camera ex parte briefings with this judge, where when they presented certain evidence. However, we have not been allowed to attend these briefings, so we don't even know what they presented to this particular judge. So, in fact, this case never really was a case as far as the real court procedures are concerned. We have been given no status hearing during this 2 years, no briefings, no oral arguments, no discovery, and yet this judge made his decision after allowing the government attorneys to present their case to him privately, in camera, ex parte, not allowing us to participate in these cozy sessions.
Now, this was not the first judge to handle this case, right?
Correct. Originally, my case was assigned to another judge. However, about a few months, and actually, the case was pretty active. A few months later, mysteriously, the case moved to this particular judge, Judge Reggie Walton, who was appointed by President Bush. And the case sat there in front of him, inactive, for almost 2 years, with no hearings, no arguments. He would cancel court dates, then he would set up other court dates, and then he would cancel it 24 hours in advance.
So now that he's thrown it all out, is that the end of it?
Oh, no. We are appealing. We are appealing this case immediately.
1-800-423-8255, the number to join our conversation this hour to Boston, Massachusetts. Rachel's with us. Hi, Rachel.
Hi. I wanted to respond to the question you posed earlier about whether we should trust the government to classify these documents as secret. And my opinion is that in the abstract, theoretically, if I trusted this administration, I might go along with classifying some documents as secret in the interests of national security. But in this case, I feel this particular administration has consistently misled or actually lied to the public about information. So I don't trust them and their decisions. Also, Ms. Edmonds raised the issue that some of this, they were saying that it was because they needed to keep good diplomatic relations. And that sounds really like a joke to me, because this particular administration, to me, has done so much to make our international relations deteriorate. So it really does come down to an issue of trust for me. I don't have a global belief that an administration should never be able to limit what's open to the public.
What's interesting about this one, though, Rachel, and I'm going to ask Michael Kirkpatrick to join us on this, is that in this rare case, we have a pretty good idea of what information was out there before the government stepped in and demanded that it be reclassified. More often than not, we never get to see what is classified as top secret or however it is classified. Those decisions are made before the information is ever out there. So Michael, when we know what was there and then we see that the government moved to reclassify it, what do we learn about the standard that this government has set for what should be secret and what shouldn't?
Well, I think what we learn is we get an insight into the purpose for which information is being classified. And there's only one appropriate purpose, and that's to really protect national security. It's an improper purpose if something is being classified to try to hinder congressional oversight of the department or prevent embarrassment or political damage or shield it from legitimate public inquiry, or to put this information out of reach of people who have court cases. We've talked a lot about Ms. Edmonds' case, but there is also a case that is filed in New York by families of victims of 9/11 against some folks in Saudi Arabia who they allege have some connections to financing the attacks. That lawsuit, they wanted to call Ms. Edmonds as a witness. They wanted to use some of this information to try to establish their claims. And because it has been reclassified, and because Ms. Edmonds is not being allowed to talk about the specifics of what she knows, that is putting it out of reach of the court system.
This takes us back to this time last year when there was the 9/11 commission report with all those lines and pages blacked out that people raised questions about Saudi Arabia. Am I right about that?
Yes, that's correct. And to sort of take one step back, in the usual course, when information is classified and it's within the exclusive control of the government, the only way we find out about that is if we file a Freedom of Information Act request, and the government then comes back and says, we have X number of documents that are responsive, but you can't have them because they're exempt from disclosure because they're classified. Then we can go to the court, and the court will take a look at those documents in camera, and we just have to trust the court
right. That
they are properly classified. This time around, it is different because the information was out in the public. We know what's there, and the government has come back and tried to reclassify it. That's what makes this a very interesting case.
Michael, excuse me. Let me go ahead to David, who's joining us on the line from Norfolk, Virginia. Hello, David.
Hey, how are you doing?
Thanks for calling.
Hey, I got two questions for Ms. Edmonds.
She's on the line, so she can talk right to you. Go ahead, David.
Okay, good. Your job when you were hired on at the FBI, was it to be a translator or was it to be an interpreter of your opinion upon the documents that you were given to translate?
I did all. When you're a contract linguist, they have various levels. For example, if you're hired as a translator monitor, then you only can translate documents. However, because of the qualification levels and their result of their testings, they placed me as contract linguist, and I was performing all that those various tasks in terms of interpreting documents and also translating for live interviews and translating for written documents from one language to another and then the other way. So it encompassed all those.
So when you say the difference between translation and interpretation, I think this is what David was getting at, are you asked as a translator to tell your superiors that you think this is important or that this needs further work or this needs to be pursued, or is it a more sort of mechanical function where you're saying this is what is in that wiretap, etc.?
That's a very good question. It dependent on the agent, and certain agents, they actually would want to go beyond literal translations, because literal translations sometimes alone won't mean anything to you. However, once you put it in context by having information regarding certain political situations of the target country and the current news there, etc., then you can provide opinion, which, again, as I said, dependent on agents. Many field agents, they were very open and they would come. Let's say they would come to me and say, okay, you also attached a little note here saying this is very significant. I want to talk to you about this. Then I would give this agent background on certain target and the roots of certain issues within that document as it related to that particular country, that particular country's political issues, and etc.
Okay, David, is that the direction that you want to hear from Sabelle?
Okay, well, yeah, that's basically what I was asking about. The my main concern was that the document that she translated or retranslated, and she voiced her opinion on it, and I think, you know, 6.5 months, I think that's how long she was there, of experience at the FBI, you know, she shouldn't be trying to voice her opinion about these papers that she was translating.
Saying now, that in effect she was a little bit beyond her standing at the FBI? She shouldn't have been so critical?
Well, not critical, but see, when you work for the FBI, you are you're an employee of the government. And the only thing they want you to do is basically do your job, and that's it. Don't give your opinion, you know, if it was wrong or whatever. Just do your job and be quiet. That's the only thing the government wants you to do.
You're a taxpayer. And, is that what you want government employees to do, David?
Well, I want the people that are in charge and have the experience to take care of such things as this paper that she had retranslated.
Right.
To take it, you know, and do with what they have to do with it. Now, what she did with it was, she said, okay, my opinion is this was wrong, and, you know, you blocked this out on purpose to, and now it's becoming a political item. And now it's becoming another, I hate to say it, but another way to bash Bush.
Yeah, okay, and, fair enough. We actually have another caller from West Roxbury who's making the same point, and I probably won't have a chance to get to that, but let's hear from Sabelle on this.
Okay, Dick. Again, I'm glad to hear this question because it gives me a chance to answer. I did not come out with this information to the public, to the press. I had faith in the system, in our system. I believed my duty was to report it to appropriate people, being the Senate Judiciary Committee or the Inspector General's office, and I sat there for 1.5 years waiting to see actions being taken. But what I saw was...
There wasn't a part of you, Sabelle, that went first to your superior and said, I think this is a problem, waited for your superior to say, actually, no, and it's none of your business, get back to your work, and you went, oh, okay.
I did for 3 months. I waited for them for 3 months. And their responses, that was what alarmed me, because the response was, this is going to be a can of worms. If we were to admit to one issue, then we have to shake up the whole department. This is not what we're going to do. So let's sweep it under the rug. And after 3 months, deciding, let's do the appropriate thing and take it to people who have the oversight. So I took it to those people, and I patiently sat there. I said, okay, Inspector General is going to issue a report, and the Senate, they are conducting investigations. But seeing that these people have been relentlessly fighting and quashing and covering up and blocking and gagging, that is when I decided that this case needs to get into the public court, because people need to know about this. Family members need to know about this. And people like you, people like your listeners, they need to know about these issues and about the facts. Because without knowing it, in fact, that is when we are more at risk of having our national security being jeopardized.
You sound like you've lost a... more than a little bit of faith in the way these systems are supposed to operate.
Well, I'm still here and I'm still fighting, right? So I guess that's a good sign. But I am appealing this case, and I hope I will see certain action by the Congress, because they are the representatives. It shouldn't be my job doing this right now and trying to get this and try to get them addressed. It should be theirs. That's why we go out there and we elect. Before these issues, I thought, okay, I pay my taxes. Okay, I abide by the laws, and I vote once a year, and that is it. That is my obligation, and I am fulfilling it. But I realize that it takes more than that, because to maintain your democracy, to maintain your system of checks and balances, it's a constant vigilance, a constant struggle. And I believe it's all of us' duty, because you see what's happening with the Congress. Where are these representatives? They are complying with this illegal gag order. Even though it says illegal, even though National Security Archive declared it something that is not legit, yet they remove this information and they are not reacting the way they should be reacting. And that is when you start being alarmed about our system of checks and balances. They're supposed to be checking and balancing each other. And since it's broken and since it's not working, here I am talking.
I suspect we will talk again. Sabelle, thank you so much for being with us on the program.
Thank you.
Sabelle Edmonds, former FBI translator. Michael Kirkpatrick, I want to thank you for your time as well.
Thank you.
Michael is an attorney at the Public Citizen Litigation Group in Washington. And a little bit later today, Sabelle Edmonds will be holding a news conference to talk about how she goes ahead with this. You can find relevant links and more information regarding the story of Sabelle Edmonds on our website. We are at www.theconnection.org. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.